Good morning, all. It's another beautiful day. Your attention, please.
Hey there. Thanks for checking out the first episode of Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast. We're going to be covering all 17 episodes of the British sci-fi classic, The Prisoner, talking about its concepts, themes, style, and all that good stuff. Whether you're new to the show or a longtime Prisoner fan, I hope you enjoy and find some of what we say entertaining or at the very least, interesting. So here we go. We start off with some backstory on The Prisoner and then get into the thick of the first episode in the series, Arrival. Enjoy. Okay, good morning. This is the first episode of Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast. All about the classic 1967 sci-fi television show, The Prisoner, starring Patrick McGoohan. My name is Clay McCormick from EatDeadMeat.com, and with me is Wes Teasdale from ThePenskeyFile.com.
How's it going, guys?
And we're here to talk about The Prisoner. Why are we talking about The Prisoner? Well, there are so many other television podcasts out there for shows that are... not great. And The Prisoner is my favorite TV show. And I think there's real. It's only 17 episodes, but there's a lot to talk about. It definitely has a focus and a vision behind it, and it's very unique. And as far as unique television shows go, I'd say you've got Star Trek, you've got The Twilight Zone, and you've got The Prisoner. And those are like the top three science fiction shows that everything that comes after it steals from in some way.
Sure. And not to interrupt, but I had never heard of The Prisoner before this.
Correct. So I am a big Prisoner fan, you know, clearly. And Wes has heard of the show about 2 weeks ago. So I've seen every episode multiple times. Wes has seen none of the episodes before the one that we covered.
The podcast will be you telling me about the episodes.
It'll just be like, me wow, that describing sounded great. The episode. Yeah, you go, that's wow, I would love to see that. That sounds really interesting.
Can I download that somewhere?
Yeah. So it'll be interesting because, you know, he has no idea what's coming. I know what's coming, so it'll be interesting to talk about it. So there'll be no spoilers for future episodes in whatever episode we're covering.
Absolutely.
So just a little background on the show. The main creative force of the show is an actor named Patrick McGoohan, who was a... Irish actor who was on a television show called Danger Man. And Danger Man started in 1960, actually predates the James Bond movies. And Patrick McGoohan actually turned down the role of James Bond when they offered it to him. And that show is a pretty straightforward spy thriller. It started off as a half an hour show and then later became a full hour show. And he did that for four seasons, and then he either got tired of doing it, or the American investors decided they weren't interested anymore.
He's not a creator of Danger Man, right?
No, he's not.
Just
no.
An actor.
Yes, he's just the actor. Okay. But by the time the fourth season of Danger Man rolled around, he was the highest paid actor in the UK. So he was a big deal.
Danger Man is a British show.
Danger Man is a British show. Right. It was imported to the U.S. under the title Secret Agent. Okay. It's actually where the song Secret Agent Man comes from. That is from that show.
That's him.
Yeah.
And just to clarify, the bombshell you dropped on me and Amy, who are watching this with you, where he's Longshanks in Braveheart.
Yes, correct.
He's the king, the evil king in Braveheart. So that if you're unfamiliar with Patrick McGoohan, is that then, that's... That would be the place to end, I suppose. He's dead now.
Yes, he died in 2009, unfortunately. But yeah, so he did Danger Man for four seasons, and then he decided to stop, or they decided to stop. And he wanted to do something else, but he wanted to do something. He was tired of doing straight-ahead spy thriller things, and he wanted to do something really unique and really different. And it's at this point that he teams up with the script editor from Danger Man mm-hmm. and his own production partner named David Tomlin.
Yep.
And they... there's a lot of controversy over who came up with the idea. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think the script editor, George Markstein, is the originator of the idea, and McGoohan just kind of like put some trappings on it.
Yep.
There's other people who think it was all McGoohan, and these other people kind of paid. So basically, for the sake of argument,
it was the Goodwill Hunting problem.
So for the sake of argument, we're going to say they all created the show, but McGoohan clearly was the driving force because he added a lot of interesting touches, and a lot of the weirdness seems to come from him.
Okay.
And they mapped out this thing called The Prisoner, which was a jump off of an idea about where do spies go when they retire.
Okay.
And in the very first season of Danger Man, the very first episode takes place at this resort town in northern Wales called Port Marion. And it's a very strange place. It's in Wales, but it's Mediterranean architecture.
Yep.
And it's the architect wanted to show that you could exploit the natural beauty of a place mm-hmm. without defiling it. So it's got very hilly and have all these beautiful buildings built into the natural landscape. And it's a very interesting place.
Yep.
And this stuck in McGoohan's brain. And so when it came time to pick the place that they were going to make this, you know, prison for spies mm-hmm. or retirement home for spies, this is the first place that popped into his head.
So was this actually shot in that place?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
All the exteriors are Port Marion.
Okay. We don't have to go. We can get into this a little bit later. But I was shocked by, I could not tell if they had built this place mm-hmm. for what it was or if it was some sort of carnival resort,
yeah,
like weird,
yeah,
yeah. Okay,
it's more that. Yes, yeah, they found this place, this amazing existing place, mm-hmm. and they shot all the exteriors in Port Marion, and then all the other stuff is sets.
Gotcha.
So yeah, so they started originally. They wanted CBS wanted 36 episodes of The Prisoner. McGoohan said, "There's no way I can do that. I was only planning on doing 7 because right. it's a British TV show, and anything over 7 or 10 episodes seems like forever for them right. for some reason."
Yep.
And the compromise came down to 17. So McGoohan took the production team from Danger Man, moved them into The Prisoner, and they started writing. And the show premiered in September of 1967 and ended on February 1st in 1968.
Yeah, I'm surprised they did one series of 17. I don't know what British television was like at the time, but that seems like a very long British television series for them. You know, when they're used yeah. to 6 episodes.
Yeah. Well, I think it was, if I had to guess, I mean, I don't know anything about that stuff, but yeah. if I had to guess, I'd say it was, you know, the Danger Man series was 22. It was a 22 episode, or 20, you know, oh, regular right. size season. So they wanted something like that. But McGoohan didn't think the idea could last past many episodes.
Right.
You know, so yeah. he planned on doing 7.
Sure.
So ended up with 17. And those 17 episodes are what we're going to be covering with. We might throw in an episode later about Danger Man, looking into some episodes from that and seeing how that could have influenced this show. And we'll see. We'll start off with the first episode. It's called Arrival. It's directed by Don Chaffee, written by George Markstein and David Tomlin, with a rewrite by McGoohan, which seem to be common. Again, depending on who you talk to or what interviews you read, he was involved hardly at all, or he was involved very heavily.
Right.
So let's just assume that he was involved a pretty solid amount.
A 50% of the
reality. At least.
It's strange he might just be of the times, but he does not have his name on as a writer for a creator credit.
Right.
Which is in America, you usually have to write the first script and you become the creator of the show.
Right, right. Yeah, his name pops up. He pops up as a writer, I think. I think he pops up on this episode? No, in later ones. Yeah. And I believe he pops up as a director. He directed 5 episodes, and a few of them under different names. I'm not exactly sure why. hopefully when we get there, I'll be able to explain why.
Remember why.
The first thing you see, obviously, is this intro credit scene, which is very unique, and with a theme song by Ron Grainer, who actually also wrote the Doctor Who theme. The thing I love about it is it tells you everything you need to know about the setup for the show.
Yep.
You get guy resigning, clearly at some sort of high stress, high level job.
Yes.
You get the fact that he's been kidnapped and he awakes in the village.
Yep.
And you get that in every episode.
Okay.
Before the episode starts, you get all of the expository information and background you need about Number 6 and what the village is and why he's there. Which I think is fantastic, because then it allows you to just watch the story they're telling you and not worry about any of the peripheral stuff, because they give it to you at the front.
That's true. It's as a sort of modern TV person who had never seen it, it's shocking how long the introduction is, like relatively, and how late any Chirons come on the screen to let you know that this is an actual introduction.
Right.
And honest to God, it is essentially an episode worth of stuff that he does in his intro credits. And I also like the fact that he stops and pulls the ticket out before he parks his car, which was a nice little break.
I think it's a really great way to start the show. Mm-hmm. Because you get right away that this character is a very individualist person, and
he's an agent, I think. He has some kind of job where he would be barging into people's offices.
The thing that's actually kind of great about it is they don't tell you what the job is.
Right.
And some of the interesting stuff as far as Danger Man is concerned is there is a lot of speculation over whether or not Number 6 is supposed to be John Drake, his character. He claims no.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of other people involved who claim that it is supposed to be. I think it's just a matter of when they were making the show, it was so weird that he said to everybody, just pretend it's John Drake and we'll go from there. He's a spy. He uses the pre-existing knowledge of him and his show, Danger Man, to kind of ease you into this new thing.
Right.
So you see him, you see John Drake, who looks like John Drake. Very similar.
Surprisingly similar to John Drake.
And you see, you're automatically thinking spy.
Yep.
So you can go from there. He used his pre-existing fame and whatnot to, as a jumping off point.
Right, to set the stage without having to actually get into it.
Right. But yeah, so the overall, one of the big themes is individualism and speaking out against forces that want to control you, and there you never having a will of your own. And I think they set that up actually very well in the opening credits by immediately setting a tone of false escape when he walks through this doorway that says "Way Out." It just in the same lettering, same font they use on the village.
Yeah,
it's just this big door that just says "Way Out" on it.
Right, and it's his way in. You know, he's going in, but it says "Way Out."
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
And it really kind of sets the tone for everything else that comes after.
We'll be open in a minute.
What's the name of this place?
You're new here, aren't you?
Where?
Do you want breakfast?
Where is this?
The village.
Yes.
I'll see if coffee's ready.
Where's the police station?
There isn't one.
Can I use your phone?
Oh, we haven't got one.
Where can I make a call?
Well, there's a phone box around the corner.
And once he awakens and looks at his surroundings, the second, quote-unquote character you're introduced to in the show is the village.
Yeah.
Because, exactly as you're saying, it's a very out-of-time-looking kind of place.
Mm-hmm.
It's got this Mediterranean architecture, but
it's clearly in Britain.
Yeah, and it's clearly like kind of rainy and all the time. And, and you've got people wearing... It's delightfully square in its the way it's got kind of these strange, very British kind of things, like the flat straw hats and the blazers and stuff.
Yeah.
But it also has these very 60s kind of things, like you've got your lava lamps.
Yes, and your lava circular, lamp in every scene.
Circular chairs that number two sits in.
Yep.
And it's just, it creates this weird thing where...
In the bright color. A lot of people wear very bright against colors. Very drab. He's very drab. He's wearing all black.
Right,
and
right.
Other people are wearing like the, you know, flower power color explosion. They're not really wearing like hippies garb, but they're wearing right. colorful clothes.
And he stands out because of that. Because when he gets there, he's all in black. All black.
Yep.
And he's in the middle of this big, you know, color fart, basically.
It also does a good job of... this style that they're going for, mm-hmm. just to continue what I was talking about before, there's no better way to really get into a mystery than if you watch something and you have no idea what is normal.
Right.
Like, this show is old, mm-hmm. or, I mean, it's from the 60s, so it has older things to it.
Right.
But I spend a lot of the episode going, are these people wearing strange costumes, or is this just the style at the time? I think of, like, the Abe Simpson line, I was wearing an onion on my belt because it was the style at the time. And because a lot of them are wearing zany things, mm-hmm. but I'm like, are they zany or is this just sort of them wearing, like some of it is obviously zany, but mm-hmm. then they're also, you know, British guys wearing their long dress coats. I'm like, maybe they were still wearing that at this point in British like culture. So there's no better way to like really be mystified by something mm-hmm. than to have it be old enough to the point where you don't recognize the culture, and if they're actually intentionally doing something weird, like number two is wearing a scarf.
Yep.
And I was like, is that important?
Umbrella.
The umbrella makes sense because it's British. Like, I understand them all carrying umbrellas, but the scarf, I was like, I spent an inordinate amount of time looking at the scarf, being like, what is that scarf all about? Why is this guy wearing that scarf?
Right. And I think you can look at that two ways. I think you can look at it as being dated and square.
Yep.
But given that the whole idea of the village, as you find out later, is that it's this prison for these people who have, you know, sensitive information.
Sure.
Who have resigned or quit. And whoever their handlers are can't risk them going out into the wild, so they send them to this place, right?
Yep.
And the key to everything in the village is complacency and positivity and making sure that everybody feels comfortable so they have no reason to speak out. And I think that's where some of that design comes into play, because it's so delightfully square mm-hmm. that I don't think it feels dated as much as it does reinforce this sort of like kitschiness factor.
Yeah.
Where you have the bright colors that are making people feel good, and it's a very comforting, weird kind of place that I think works. I think it still works.
Yeah.
Even now.
Yeah.
And its weirdness kind of does take it out of time a little bit.
Yeah, it does. It makes it seem more foreign than it maybe was at the time, which mm-hmm. is sort of an interesting way that they would actually take those things.
The saying here, the still tongue makes a happy life.
Yeah. And that actually brings me to another thing I want to talk about, which is the signage in the city, in the village, is all the same font, all the same typeface, and it's very uniform. And the last time I was watching it really reminded me of the Keep Calm and Carry On posters from World War II.
Yes. Is it in that font, or is it just
it's a different font. It just reminded me.
Yeah, it's a very like regal font.
Right. And well, and that, and plus the phrasing on them. So the two that they point out in this episode are a still tongue makes for a happy life.
Right. Oh, you're talking about these signs. Yes, yes.
Yes. And the other one is questions are a burden to others and answers are a prison to oneself.
Yes.
It's like, what the hell does that mean? But both of these things are very non-threatening, but it's sort of like a keep your head down and stay quiet, nobody gets hurt.
An implied threat over anything.
Right. And once I thought about the keep calm and carry on, I actually went and I actually didn't know what the origin of that was. So I looked it up. Apparently that was the third in a series of three posters from the Second World War.
Yes.
The first two being more go get 'em patriotic. One of them was, I think, our freedom is in peril.
Yep.
Only you can help us fight, or something like that. The Keep Calm and Carry On actually was never published. It was never put out.
Oh, really?
It was reserved for if the Germans invaded and took England.
Oh, really?
Which I found really fascinating.
Well, it feels like a poster you could put up after London had been firebombed into the ground. Like, you'd imagine that would be the sort of British propaganda at that point of...
But if you think about it as reserved specifically for when England has been taken over by an enemy power, you've got two meanings behind that phrase. One, which is, I think, the way everybody usually looks at it, which is, you know, keep your head up, just do what you're going to get through this. But the other one is, keep quiet, stay calm, nobody gets hurt. And I found that shockingly similar to the way they approach that stuff in The Prisoner, where it's a affirmation, but at the same time, it's kind of a threat.
Yeah.
Why did you speak to me in French?
French is international.
I suppose it's a waste of time asking the name of this place.
As a matter of fact, I thought it might be Polish, perhaps a Czech.
What would Poles or Czechs be doing here?
It's very cosmopolitan. You never know who you meet next.
And so we learn it's an international community right away. You've got the woman who pulls up.
With my favorite line. Sorry, you can continue. No,
I was just going to say, the woman who pulls up on the car speaks to him in French
because
she says it's an international language, and he might be French, or maybe he's Polish or Czech.
And he reacts very poorly to Czechs or Poles being anywhere in this village. I wrote down what he said. I think he says, why would there be a Czech or a Pole in this village? So we understand his sort of racist character.
I wouldn't call it racist.
No, he's more just
everybody's speaking with an English accent. So why would you expect anything?
No,
else,
he wouldn't understand why I check a pull. I just his reading of the line is very funny.
Well, that's the thing. His every line he delivers in basically the entirety of the show is either angry or like spiteful.
Yes,
or you know, with a sort of sarcasm to it, where he's
delightfully sarcastic.
Yeah, and that question he asks, he's doing that to try and get information. He's like, well, why would there be Polish or Czechs here?
Yeah,
you know, what kind of place is this?
Mm-hmm.
And they set up the village right away as a place where you can't do anything for yourself. You can't drive.
Yeah.
You can't open doors. All the doors are automatic.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And
you don't fix anything.
You don't fix anything.
Stuff for you. Yeah.
He walks into number two's place for the first time. They've got his breakfast.
Yep.
You know, down to the T, because they know everything about him.
Yeah.
And again, I think this accents the idea that all of this stuff seems like a benefit, but what it is in reality is just them controlling everybody there.
Yep.
At least that's the way that number six looks at it.
Right. Man of specific tastes. He only will have two eggs with his bacon and lemon tea.
Correct.
It's just, there are just certain Britishisms to this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, tea is, my father's British and my grandparents live in Britain. And tea in this show is treated just like it is over there, where tea is completely unironic.
Yes.
Like, there is, you're... A man has been captured against his will and is sitting down with his captor, and they are legitimately interested in the kind of tea that they're going to be having, China or Indian tea with a lemon in it. And he likes his two eggs with his bacon and toast. And it's just, I was struck by, he obviously must just have that every single day of his life.
Yeah. His cholesterol must be terrible.
Just to pin it down. Well, he does a lot of running.
Maybe that's why he's there. It's an intervention for his eating habits, because clearly he is not eating very healthily.
Clearly out of control.
Is your number six?
Yes.
Just one moment, I have a call for you.
Good morning to you. I hope you slept well. Come and join me for breakfast. Number two, the Green Dome.
So this is where we meet number two for the first time.
The original number two.
The original number two, the first number two. And his butler, who his butler is one of the only characters who pops up in every episode.
The Ajabi looking guy?
Yes, okay. Yes. So what did you think of the first number two?
First, I'm more memorable of the second number two. The first one is the scarf one.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think he left that big of an impression. I thought the second guy was better in the role. The first guy really just exists to sort of explain why he's there, which I also didn't realize until the second time watching it.
Mm-hmm.
My first time, I've watched this twice now. And the first time I was much more in the dark about why he was there. And in the second time I noticed that they actually pretty much spell out why he is there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's, again, that's what I love about it, is there's no question about why he's there or what they want from him.
Right.
Which allows you to then, as you'll see in the later episodes, that frees you to just sort of enjoy the story and not worry about a lot of the motivations.
Right, okay.
It'll be easier to talk about this after you watch the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
Fun little trivia fact, when they go over his birthday, the birthday that he tells them is actually Patrick McGowan's birthday.
Is that his actual time of birth? He knew a lot of information about his birth.
but yeah, that's where number six is introduced to the concept that they have been following him forever.
They have a picture book of his most private moments for some reason.
And
not even that private, it's just him sort of getting dressed.
Right, and for some reason they mention a specific time where he came back from Tibet or something.
Yeah, it was very specific, and they took a lot of photos of that day, so I don't know if he had a wedding or something was going on.
But yes, so you learn from number two that the reason he's there is because there is a question about his resignation. They don't know why he resigned. Yep. They want to know why he resigned.
And just to be clear, he resigned in the opening credits.
Correct. Okay. He resigns in the opening credits.
Yeah.
He will not tell them why he resigned.
Yes, he insists he resigned instead of what, walked out. He did not walk out, he resigned. Right.
He resigned, I believe he says it was a matter of conscience.
Oh, okay.
And it's at this point that he drops a very famous line about, I will not be pushed, stamped, filed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered, my life is my own. Which is basically the treaties for the entire series.
Yes, it had delivered as such as well. It was like, this is the point of the show right here.
That line, that's one of my favorite line deliveries of anything.
I will not make any deals with you. I've resigned. I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered. My life is my own.
And he's always glaring, like we were talking about earlier. Every line he delivers, he's either looking down at someone or he's squinting at them.
Right, because he doesn't trust anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's his whole character. The way that he approaches everything is questioning and paranoid. That's another thing about the show. You can, when you look at it from a thematic standpoint, you can look at it as the quest to remain an individual and not be thrust into conformity and be all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But there is also kind of a weird paranoia thing too. You can look at it because the way that he treats everything. He doesn't trust anybody.
Yep.
He assumes everybody's out to get him. So there's an odd, paranoia angle you can look at it too. If you think maybe McGowan was just kind of paranoid in his life.
Right,
Quite a beautiful place, really, isn't it? Almost like a world on its own. I shall miss it when I'm gone. Oh, it'll grow on you.
He is very questioning, but I was also very struck by, if this was like an American show, he would have, he would have fucked somebody up by like 5 minutes into this and been like, you tell me exactly where I am.
Right.
He's extremely polite, especially with the, him and the original number two have a charming little banter when they're in the helicopter. And he's it's such a British thing where he's like, and this is where we have a theater troupe. And he goes, I'd have to attend that sometime.
Right.
Once I'm out of here, I'd like to return and watch your theater troupe. And they do that for about like 3 minutes. And it's very, the only people I was struck by that he fights are the people who are chasing him in the golf cart on the beach. Mm-hmm. Those are the only people that he actually becomes remotely violent with, even though everyone else is. He tries to fight the ball, but we haven't gotten to that yet.
I think that that does carry over actually from Danger Man a little bit, because and also it's one of the other things I love about The Prisoner is that it's all about his wits. But as you mentioned, he runs into the giant ball, who I don't believe is mentioned by name, but is referred to as Rover.
Rover.
And
in this episode, or is that just like
that's just fan? What it's called. That's what it's called. Yeah, they refer to him as Rover later on.
Okay.
But yes, so they're walking around, and number two takes the time to show their security system, which is a giant amorphous blob of a white ball
that comes out of a fountain. Is that where...
I'm going to tell you right now, Rover's powers and abilities, very undefined.
They're like the transporter in Star Trek. It's like...
Exactly, yeah. It's, you know, just enjoy that it's there. Don't try to think about it too much.
Why? Okay, so he goes up in the helicopter. He comes down. He gets his ball thing.
Yeah.
The ball... Why does the ball attack that guy? What did that guy do something?
Honestly, every time I watch this episode, I ask myself the same question.
He's in the fountain is the only thing that I could think of.
The closest thing I can think of is that number two tells everybody to stop.
Yeah.
And this guy keeps moving around. So they use him as an example. I don't know why. It's a weird thing. It's a weird way to introduce introduce Rover.
Yes. And it's also introduced very Godzilla. The zoom pans, I guess would be called, is a very Godzilla thing. Right. Like that's all Asian cinema.
Right.
And they do it a couple times in this, and that's how they introduce the ball, just the quick zoom pan into something.
Well, so I'll give you a little history about Rover. So the original design for Rover.
To describe it, it's a giant inflated balloon that's white and it sort of bounces white around.
Ball.
The size of a man. Round. So.
And moves very fluidly and just bounces and rolls.
Sort of particularly non-threatening. It's basically just every time you run into it, it's just kind of like lightly bouncing around on the ground.
But it's got this weird like inhuman roar to it that when it comes out, and it seems non-threatening, but that's not really something. I would be terrified if I saw that coming at me.
The music adds a lot, and it basically seems like it absorbs the souls of the dead or something, because the one guy it eats.
Yeah.
It comes back. You see his face sort of trying to get out of the balloon, and they show that again when the balloon comes back. Rover, I guess. So it's like the least threatening, most threatening thing.
Yeah. Again, he may eat the souls of the dead. I don't know. It's very undefined. He does whatever they need him to do.
So that guy never comes back.
No. See, that's the funny thing, though. It's like, that guy never comes back, but they use the same effect on Six later on, and he's just, like, slightly dazed by it.
Oh, okay. Because he gets dazed by this thing, and it's kind of a funny scene where the ball just, like, is bouncing on him
as
he's on the ground. It's very... he tries to fight it, and... I mean, it's literally like he's fighting a giant balloon. Like his hands are just bouncing off
it. It looks as silly as it sounds.
Yeah.
But it also looks equally as futile as it seems.
Yes. And it's also, Rover's implied, I think, to have a greater mass than a balloon would have, because it hitting things seems to seems to have like dramatic impact on things that it actually hits.
Like I said, very undefined.
Okay. But Rover stays throughout the series?
Yes. Rover is a mainstay of the series. Okay. Yeah. And, originally, it was written into the script as this sort of very aerodynamic sort of machine.
Like a drone?
Yeah, that could climb up walls and skim across the water. And they actually built this machine.
Yeah.
And as seems to be very common in movies and TV for some reason, they didn't see it till the day they were to shoot it.
Yep.
And so they're getting ready to shoot Rover for the first time. And they bring out this thing. I'll try and put a picture of it up on the web, but it looks like a giant cake.
Okay.
With like a blue light on the top of it.
Right.
And like tassels hanging down at the bottom. And it's this fiberglass shell on top of like a go-kart.
Mm-hmm.
And the legend goes, it's supposed to fly off over the beach and skim across the water and track down number six.
Yep.
So they put a guy inside it, set it off down the beach into the water, and it sank. And clearly it was not a good design, and it looked ridiculous. And again, the other legend goes, McGowan and one of his assistant directors were basically going, well, shit, we don't have a Rover.
Yeah.
And they were trying to figure out what to do, and they both looked up into the sky and saw this white thing floating in the sky.
Sure.
And said, what the hell is that? I think it's a weather balloon.
Yep.
And McGowan looks at it, goes, that's it. That's Rover. Get me as many of those as you can find.
Yeah.
And it has a very, it's very unique. It was a great decision, because it's a very iconic thing.
Yeah.
Even though it's a very simple thing.
Yeah.
Much better than the dune buggy cake.
No, it sort of fits the theme of the the play so far too, because it's kind of it's a balloon,
right.
So it's like jovial.
Exactly.
Where
yes.
I suppose like a man hunting robot is a little bit more,
yeah, a little darker,
a little darker than a balloon.
But you kind of know where the allegiances lie.
Right. And, yeah.
It's probably not good to run into.
Yeah. This thing's just a big bouncing balloon that's sort of always right. in the background, or like not always in the background, but it's always just around. I guess right. as a threat.
And I've always been impressed with the way they make it move.
Yeah, which, I didn't see any feet underneath. I didn't know what they
right.
were doing.
It's a combination of strings pulling it across and filling it with different things. Like there's sometimes with water or mixtures of helium and oxygen just to give it like a,
give
weird
it a weird
shape.
Thing.
So yeah,
they on one side.
You know, as again, seems to be the case with a lot of the best things in movies and TV.
Yeah.
When your back's up against the wall, that's when you make your most creative decisions.
Yes. The first time he goes back into that apartment, he's on the in the village and he's looking at his apartment and he's wandering around looking at stuff and he does it for a long time. He's
right,
like sort of
right.
rummaging around for 30 seconds.
Right.
And you get the idea that, oh, it must be his apartment.
Yes.
Which you haven't really seen because all you've seen is the opening credits where he's in there for like 3 seconds and
right.
then he gets knocked out.
Right.
So you don't have any... You don't have any time to realize, like, oh, this is his apartment. You're just
right.
supposed to assume it. But, like, on modern TV, he would be walking around going, like, this is my apartment. Like, he'd
yes.
say it or something.
Right.
And this show gives you no information. It doesn't, like, it doesn't hold your hand at all.
Right.
And sometimes I wonder if it's an intentional thing or if it's a style of the time where they're like,
mm-hmm.
we don't need to tell people. Like, this is obviously his apartment.
We forgot to mention that his apartment in the village is furnished exactly like his apartment in London.
Right.
And so when he is knocked out at the beginning in his home, he wakes up in his home.
Yes.
And it's over. It's only when he looks out the window that he realizes he's not at home.
Yes.
So again, trying to make him feel comfortable, trying to make him feel relaxed,
yep.
complacent, etc. And this actually has something I've noticed only recently and has become one of my favorite little... if it's a detail... I love it, and if it's a mistake, I don't want to know about it.
Right.
So, when he you know, roughs up the maid a little bit, and tells her to get lost.
Yeah, he tells her services are not required
yes.
tomorrow.
And then the back wall of the apartment opens up into
right.
something that's more looks more like the village with the circular entrances and whatnot. But when that wall opens up, the lamp that's hanging from his ceiling is swinging as
yep.
though someone maybe hit it.
Right.
right. Now, you say, oh, that's just a mistake or whatever. But they cut to Six over at that table. And in that shot, when they cut to a close-up, the lamp is still swinging.
Still swinging.
Now, if that was just a mistake, I feel like they wouldn't go through the effort to make it continuity that lamp is swinging.
Right, especially because there are a number of scenes in this where he is obviously being filmed in front of a blue sheet of paper. Like when they're trying to shoot the sky behind him.
Yes.
It's obvious. I don't even understand why, because there are scenes where he's outside with someone and the sky is there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're shooting their mid shots. But then when they close up on him, they have obviously moved to another
right.
location.
Right.
And it's very, for something that is really, they don't seem to be putting that much effort into it. It might just be the way they were shooting at the time, and
right.
probably with British weather, you can't get too reliable. But it was very, if the lamp is swinging both shots, it seems more likely that this is a planned type
right.
thing.
Right, and it says, it's just like a simple thing,
mm.
but since, you know, that wall opens up to a section of the house that you can't see at that point, I've always taken it as being like, clearly somebody was back there doing something and knocked the lamp as they were running out of there.
That's
which,
oh, sorry, go
I was
ahead.
Just going to say, which, if that is the intent, I think is a great little detail.
Yeah, no, it would be. I didn't realize that was a change from his apartment.
I thought
they were exposing that this is exactly like, because doesn't he run in there and he looks into his closet?
Yeah, you know, honestly, maybe it is.
They've stocked it with village stuff. Like,
right.
it says village canopies, which he shakes next
right.
to his ear, which is charming. And but otherwise, yeah, I didn't... Again, it's the fact that they don't show you this in the opening
right,
credits.
Right.
You don't know what his apartment looks like.
Right.
And you're really just... Because it's not his ledger, right? Those are like village things that are written in his journal.
Right, yes. Yeah, okay. That's, again, something that you can't even do for yourself in the village. You can't listen to the music that you want because it's all pumped in from the main source. And you can't even write your own things.
Agenda.
In your, yeah, agenda. Because it says in his agenda, arrived in the village, was treated very nicely or something like that. And
it says send flowers or something.
Yeah,
somebody.
Send flowers. Yeah. Send thank you flowers for et cetera, et cetera. But yes, he goes into the kitchen and he looks into his cabinet and he sees all these village brand items, which really, that's something that I feel like has popped up in a lot of other things, like whether it's They Live or I think Repo Man does something like that, where all of these brands are very bland.
Yeah. To say obey on them, basically.
Yes, or just say peas, or just say spaghetti, or something like that.
Are they empty? Is that what I'm getting from that little bit of business he does shaking them? Are they full of peas?
I honestly never thought about it. I assume that they're full. I mean, these guys got to eat.
Yeah. I feel
just,
like...
Just laced with drugs.
His performance seems to imply that they're empty, because he shakes them and smiles. And I was like, oh, if they were a can of peas, I don't know why that would be happy. Maybe it's fake, and he's just like, everything is... fake or something.
That reminds me, there's another bit of business he does when he first wakes up that I never noticed until the last time I watched just now. When he goes to the information desk and he picks up the phone that's wireless, he doesn't understand because there's no wire. He reacts to it...
Strangely,
because it's a wireless phone, which in 1967 didn't exist.
But let's be practical. I'm interested in facts. Your only chance to get out of here is to give them to me. And if you don't give them... I'll take
because he gets knocked out.
Yeah, he tries to escape, and then Rover catches him.
Yes.
And bounces on him.
Yeah, so they have a
very
beach
lightly.
Scene.
Yes.
Beach scene where he's trying to get away. Two guys on a golf cart chase him. Those are the only people he fights.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ball catches him and knocks him out, and he wakes up in a hospital.
Oh, he's coming along nicely.
And then they give him medical tests.
Yes, they go over some very... He gets to see the inner workings of the sick bay, for lack of a better term, of the village. And it's a very strange place. He looks into this window and he sees these people who are all in straitjackets and have like blinders on and headphones. And I think the doctor says it's obsessive guilt syndrome.
Therapy for obsessive guilt.
Right. That's where Six learns... at least is introduced to the idea that the village will do anything they need to get your information,
right,
including going into your brain.
Sure.
You know, because whatever obsessive guilt complex is probably not something that those people actually have.
It seems to be a misdiagnosis.
It's probably village doctor speak for they won't tell us what we want.
Yep.
Taking Six through... The medical area is almost like a threat because, you know, he sees what they're willing to do if they have to.
Yeah.
Because then they just check him out really quick and then they let him out.
Group therapy counteracts obsessional guilt complexes producing neurosis.
Jumping ahead a little bit, obviously, the main thing that goes on there is he meets Cobb, the guy that he knows from before.
Yes.
Who then jumps out the window and kills himself.
Yes.
Supposedly.
Allegedly. We come in late to this.
Right.
Yeah.
Which then leads to a funeral procession, which, again, I love the funeral procession because you can look at it two ways. Because they use the same music, brass band music, that they... It's very up-tempo, peppy brass band music.
Well, it was the same song that they are just playing. It seems to be this band's only song. Because he runs into them earlier marching through the village and they're playing that same song.
Right, you know, marching around the village, playing this up-tempo song. It's the same song they use for a funeral, which, on the surface, you can say, oh, well, clearly, that was the only song they could afford to use. But you can also look at it as, even in a funeral, they use up-tempo, peppy music so as to not... have you focus, have the villagers focus on the fact that somebody just
died.
Killed themselves.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Yeah, he meets this number 9, which I guess is her name.
Mm-hmm.
She's dressed very brightly. And they have another one of their outdoor scenes. One of the funnier moments, I think, in the thing, where they've talked to each other. She obviously knows this guy who has killed himself, who was his friend that he met in the hospital.
Right.
Mm-hmm. She's crying at his funeral. Also, I know this isn't intentional, but it seems like very few people have ever died in the village, because I think there were only like five gravestones out there.
Yeah, it's a very small cemetery.
Yeah. It's on the beach.
Yes.
Which I don't know if that's very hygienic to bury the dead just where the tide comes in.
That's why there's so few headstones, I guess.
They just get washed away. But she meets him, and they have this exchange, and she goes, meet me at 12 or something. And then it does the weird thing of it cuts to him sitting down next to her.
Yeah, it's a hard cut. Yeah,
I noticed that. What was the point of that scene? I don't understand.
I noticed that this time, too. I don't know. She says to meet him at 12, and the bell is ringing as she says that.
Yes.
I don't know if it's supposed to be... Like, what did...
Well, there's no intercutting scene between her saying, let's meet at 12.
And then anything else.
And then it immediately cuts to him meeting her at 12. And so you're implied, like, why couldn't they just have that conversation up on the hill where no one else was around?
I think it's just one of those cut for time things where... I don't know. It's an awkward cut. Yes.
Right. Or if there was a scene that they took out. So he meets her. And she tells him about I forget the name of this device.
The ElectroPass.
ElectroPass, which...
You need an ElectroPass!
Which sounds a lot more high-tech than it actually is. It basically is a pass that lets you get out of
it's basically a key card.
A key card,
yeah.
So you can escape the island, apparently only via helicopter.
Well, I think the idea is that you need the ElectroPass in order to fly the helicopter.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's not like I don't think it's a key to walk out the door.
Imagining there's like a energy field that you need to get through.
That's a good point, because I mean, I guess Rover backs off of him because he's got the ElectroPass.
Yeah, and my first time watching it, I thought, the ElectroPass shuts down the guards, basically. Yeah. Like, no one, if you have it, you can just go wherever you want to go.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's just one of those amorphous sci-fi things where
it's a watch with three arms on it that spins around.
You're right. I want that watch.
So he gets into his helicopter and just flies off.
Uh huh.
And number nine, who at this point in the episodes, I have no idea if she is for him or against him. Right. She seems to be very conflicted either way.
Well, I think not to cut you off, but. So what he flies off, but then you find that number two is controlling the new number two, which we didn't even talk about. We can talk about that in a minute.
Oh, is he not showing up?
And so they take control of the helicopter and they steer him back. And
yes, he just lets go of the I don't know. Is it called the joy? I don't know.
Yeah,
whatever. My piloting newbiness, but he lets go of the controls and the thing just gets pulled back. Again, a very Godzilla shot when the helicopter is flying off. Mm-hmm. It is exactly how King Ghidorah leaves, in that shot where he's just flies off. And so they pull him back.
Mm-hmm. And they that's when you find out that his buddy Cobb is not dead.
Yes.
And in fact...
Cobb is the hospital guy.
Is the hospital guy.
Yeah.
And is, in fact, working with number two.
He's allowed to leave, it seems.
Yes, they allow him to leave, and he makes this reference to having new masters.
New masters.
And then they say goodbye in French. Which
that seems to be the language.
Well, it's universal.
Choice. Yeah, du jour.
And he makes reference to not to be too hard on the girl number nine, and
fuck checks.
Yeah,
just walks.
Try not to be too hard on the girl, but do not bring in the Polish. I don't want my death to be meaningless.
The Family Guy joke. The golf where they invent golf. He's like, are we all clear on the rules then? Aye. No blacks and no Jews.
Lord.
We're all pawns, my dear. Your move.
The way that they... There's two things that stand out to me about the way that the ending.
Yep.
One, that the girl... It's tough to say who you can and can't trust in the village, clearly.
Right.
But it seems that in this... instance, the girl is, as the admiral tells her when they're playing chess, she's just a pawn.
Yes.
So
very reminiscent of that wire scene, the famous wire scene where the kids are playing chess.
Right. Yeah. But a lot whiter.
And also, as far as chess goes, number six, if I was playing chess against this guy, I'd want to slap him, be like, you pay attention to the game. He's looking around. And why get involved in a game of chess if you're trying to do something else? It was a very strange, like...
Well, I think it's like, you know when you go to a hotel and you get time to kill and all they've got in the lobby is like some crappy board game? It's like, well, I've got to kill like 25 minutes and my phone isn't charged.
Just got to get into this.
So I guess we're going to play Yahtzee without all the pieces.
No, and the old man was very upset, just telling him to get his head in the game. He was very apologetic, but it was like, pick a lighter game if you're going to... Because they obviously had been playing long enough for the old man to win, unless he just blitzkrieged the hell out of him in this chess game. But yeah, it was a very strange decision. Mm. Yeah, just the ending. Just ends it.
The girl I like because I think they treat it sort of the way you'd think this would play out is that, oh, clearly the girl is working with the village and screwed over number six and et cetera, et cetera. It's like the conventional way that story would end.
Yes.
But in fact, the girl is actually just a pawn, as she's told. Yes. And
she's nervous in every scene, regardless of who she's talking to. She's talking to number two and number six, and she's nervous in both of these encounters. So,
and the twist of the episode is that his buddy is actually alive, and his buddy's working for the village. Now, the only problem I have with this episode, as you'll find as we go on, they have plot turns and stuff that are a little bit tighter than this, and have a little bit more focus.
Yep.
Whereas this. I don't think revealing Cobb to be working with the village really means anything.
Well, I think you're doing it maybe more service than it deserves to call it a twist. It seems painful, like him jumping out the window. It seems, the minute it happens, you're like, oh, this is not what actually happened at all. Yeah. So it's it's not very subtle.
But just that whole setup, right? it tells you that the village is willing to go for the long game. Because if you think about the whole purpose of that, it is not to get any information from Six, because he just he pretends to kill himself. I mean, the only thing it really does is it outs the girl as being like a dissenter, and shows number Six that he can't fly away.
Right.
So it's really that story turn is really for the audience's sake more than it is for the sake of the story.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
No, I'd agree with that. Yeah, it's he. Maybe something will change in the future, but Six, our lead character, does not really gain anything by
from this happening. And neither does the village. The village does gain anything from
this turn.
Yeah, turn from Cobb or turning the play. All you really get is the thing that nobody can be trusted. We don't know who runs this place,
and friends are sort of against him for whatever reason. Exactly, the stakes are high.
Mm-hmm. But he answers to the new number two. Which is, I believe, the only time in the series that they change number twos mid-episode. But every episode following, except for a couple, have different number twos.
Different actors.
And I really like the way they use that convention in this, because the first number two is very amiable, very nice. Just kind of wants to be buddies with number six.
Yep.
And clearly, his methods don't work. So he's just...
Jettisoned
completely silent. What Six says, what happened to the other guy? And he says, well, I'm number two now. No, that's all they say.
And you can never talk to number one.
Right, yes. Forget about that. Don't worry about number one. And the guy they bring in, it's a very much a good cop, bad cop kind of thing, where the first guy's method was very cordial, and that didn't help and didn't work.
Right.
So the next guy flat out tells him, you're going to tell me what I want you to tell me, or I'm going to take the information. And that's one of the really fun things they do with this show is every number two you see has a very distinct approach, and it's kind of a cool thing where, you get to see this week's number two take his shot at number six,
right?
And then if he doesn't succeed, it's like, oh shit, and then he's just gone.
No, it's a good way to make a character be completely not. Serial. That's not really the word I'm looking for, but you can make the character just sort of be all over the place and have it make sense in terms of story if they're different characters.
Right, right.
I have taken his place. I am the new number two.
Get number one.
As far as you're concerned, I'm in charge.
But yeah, that's the main thrust of the episode. There's one thing we didn't talk about that I want to mention is the sign-off that everybody uses, the hand up to the eye, be seeing you.
Oh, right.
Which is, I feel like, is such a loaded thing, because it's just a common a courtesy to say to someone, but everybody in the village says it, so yep. It borders on some sort of not malicious brainwashing, but it's clearly something that they've drilled into everybody.
Right, like it's the only sort of made up thing in right. terms of like it's not what people would do in real life. Like they
right.
they basically give you an okay sign where your thumb and forefinger are together up to their eye, and they like right. they're throwing a dart. They kind of like go at you like that, and he notices it when the map keeper
yes.
is the first.
Yeah, and it's what's interesting there, too, is I just noticed it this last time. When he walks into the shop, the map keeper is speaking some different language to the woman who's there.
Yeah,
and as soon
French.
As he sees... It's probably French, yeah. It's not Czech or Polish, we know that much.
God.
At least I hope not. But as soon as he sees six, he switches back to...
English.
English, which yeah. is pretty interesting. Excuse me. But, so be seeing you is something that everybody says, and... It's got this element of a cordial sign-off, but also it's got a implication of...
Big brother.
Big brother, everybody's watching you.
Yep.
And at the same time, if you listen to the way Six says it, he doesn't say it until deep into the episode, and it's the first bit of... He's not settling,
yep.
but he's...
Becoming accustomed to it or whatever.
Right, well, he's...
When does he say it? Who does he say it to?
When the guy comes in to fix the radio.
Oh.
And they have that business about the being faster to walk or whatever.
Yes.
And he says, I think I'll take a stroll. I'll be seeing you. He's like, oh, into you. And...
He absorbed it very quickly. And, but, sorry, not to get distracted, but no. Is that guy a clone?
I don't know. I don't know if he... I don't think he ever shows. I think it's just a weird thing.
Where it's just a weird coincidence that the gardener.
Yeah, I mean it's meant to be like
unsettling.
This, yeah, unsettling. Yeah. Is this a clone? Is it? It's not something I don't think they ever dealt with.
Okay, all right.
But yes, when he finally, I mean he finally drops the "be seeing you" sign, and it's not him settling, but it's sort of his way of drawing his cards back a little bit, where
right.
he's going to see how things play out. And, you know, act accordingly that way.
Sure.
But if you listen to him in this episode and through the rest of the series, every time he says it, it's always with like a fuck you kind of thing. Like, yeah. It's like snarky and sarcastic, and it's never like the, oh, be seeing you. It's
not
like
be
seeing it. It's yeah. very, it's very, you know,
loaded.
Biting.
Yeah.
And it's just such a great multi-layered thing to be the call sign for the whole concept.
Yeah. No, it's clever. I didn't even... I mean, I obviously noticed it, but it's not something that stuck with me as
well,
much as some
they
of the
say
other
it a lot.
They just say, yeah, they'll start getting into
get
it.
Get used to it.
Be seeing you. No, it makes sense. It's, yeah, it's definitely what you're saying. It's just sort of a way for Big Brother. Like, it's like a little peephole. Like, they're basically making a little, like, camera
right,
lens
right,
or whatever in
right.
front of their eye with their fingers.
Be seeing you.
And you.
So... As a newcomer to the series, what did you think about the first episode overall?
It's, so I'll go through my general thought process here. First time watching it, I'll stick to my comments of, I was like, is this of the time or is this like a stylistic thing that's going on? After seeing Danger Man and all that, it obviously seems more stylistic. The way they get into it is very clever, with the intro credits sort of being essentially an episode in and of itself, and they get out into, they can immediately get into what the village is all about. The looking at it as a, on a writer term, it's funny because in the Star Trek podcast that I'm doing, I always get very annoyed by the A and B stories, like when they don't sort of work out.
Right.
This is very old, and this is probably going to sound more insulting than I actually mean it, but things seem very slow when there's only the A storyline. You're never not with number six at any point in
right.
this episode.
Right.
And it's slightly longer than a normal TV drama. It's like 49 minutes,
I think.
So,
yeah.
So 42 or 44 would be normal for like a drama on NBC at this point. But it's you never leaving that character is like, wow, this... There's like a lot going on, and it also brings up the weird things, like when he's like, I'll meet you in 2 hours, and then they just cut to 2 hours later and they're there. Is there ever a point where there's a B storyline that comes into anything?
Yes and no. They do focus on other characters. I mean, they always focus on him.
Yep.
He's always the centerpiece of what's going on. But they do have other things. So you bring up a... It's interesting you say that, because the first time I watched the show...
Yep.
Excuse me. You know, I got the disc from Netflix, threw in the first episode. I knew about it, but I wasn't super familiar with it.
Sure.
Watched the first episode. It didn't really grab me that much.
Yep.
I thought it was kind of boring. Sent it back, and I didn't watch the rest of the series for like at least a year.
Yep.
It just, there's something, it never grabbed me to the point where I needed to come back. It wasn't until I watched the next episode and really got to see, oh, this is what the show is going to be like.
Sure.
That really kind of hooked me.
Yep.
I think because this first episode is so expository and there's so much you got to take in.
Yes.
You got to learn the concept. You got to learn what the village is. You got to learn the rule. All this kind of stuff. They throw it all at you and you have to absorb it all.
Yeah. I think it would... It is weird. I think it would almost... Because I honestly felt the same way, too. Like, the first time... The first time was also... I think I'll have to watch each episode twice, or at least...
Yeah.
You know, the first time I watched it, it was like... I was sort of... It's a lot of information, and I was sort of unclear about what was coming at me.
Mm-hmm.
The second time, I got a better grasp on what was going on with everything, but I thought it was a weird choice that they don't particularly try to make it a mystery to sort of draw you in.
Right.
Because it's a mystery to him for about a minute, and then someone comes in and goes, this is not a mystery at all. This is exactly what's happening.
Right.
And you go, oh, that's strange. So I think it, maybe as a storytelling thing, it slightly suffers from the fact that it's not really all that, it's sort of weird as opposed to mysterious.
Yes. I think the way they tend to play it is less mysterious and more... Like you're going to be watching a battle of wits between six and number two.
Sure.
And what is number two going to do this time to try and break number six?
Yep.
And then conversely, how number six, you know, works his way out of it and turns the tables and that kind of thing. Which is never really, there are episodes that definitely have twists and turns to them.
Yep.
But it's not really a mystery.
Right. Which is surprising given... If you were to describe this...
Yeah.
Someone would be like, this must be a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And it is more of a sci-fi.
Oh, yeah, yes.
I mean, obviously it's a sci-fi, but it's... I just think it would be funny if you explain this, the premise of a man is kidnapped and wakes up on a village where no one is telling him what's going on. Everyone seems to be very strange.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, there must be some nefarious thing afoot. And that was my impression the first time. And then the second time you actually realize that, no, he's clearly being told. Like, they're not even lying to him.
Exactly,
like, it's like, this is honest. They're honestly doing this to you.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting sort of way to see it. And I mean, it's always the first show of every show. First episode of every show is always a little bit weird from the rest of it, you know, because you got to lay the groundwork for it. So,
And the thing that really stood out to me the first time I saw the show was the driving force of everything is why did number six resign? And that's the most mystery. There's one other big mystery element, but that's the main mystery that drives the whole show.
Right.
And
what's all the bad guys are interested in.
Right. That's you know, scene. And, you know, I mean, that's the reason he's there. Why did he resign?
Right.
But I think you're going to find that that doesn't matter as much as you think it will.
Okay.
Like, that's the... It's really used as a brilliant framing device I'd say it's a framing device because everything that goes on is, why did you resign? Why did you resign? And that is the jumping off point for whatever story they're going to tell.
Okay.
So you'll see what I mean as we get into it a little bit more.
Absolutely.
But I hope you enjoyed it.
No, because... I didn't. I did enjoy it. No, it was good. Because
if you didn't like it, this is going to be 17 episodes of you shitting on my favorite TV show. I thought the prisoner was great, Wes. Shut up. That's the big white ball. That's just cool.
You see the way it bounces? You don't get that shit in this.
This is sometimes movie. Helium and sometimes... Shut up, Wes.
No, it's a... it's definitely... I mean, it's the same. It's the same thing as everything. It's the same with Star Trek at this point. It's just, you know, it seems old,
right?
And you're like you the mystery of the, like I was mentioning before, of the how they're setting things up.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have to, it'll definitely take more than one episode to understand that. Oh, they're not trying to be sort of bizarre with these choices that they're making in terms right. of like costuming or like what he's or if they are, it's a, like a slightly thing. But no, it's interesting and it's definitely something that's like. Something that I can imagine opening up, and especially if you're mentioning with the different number twos, I'm going to start getting their numbers confused. But yeah, the different number twos leading into different things. It seems obvious you could go places right, with that right. sort of idea.
Yeah, and they have some crazy shit going on. So
no spoilers, but does the story wrap itself? Or
yes.
It has an ending? Like, you'd be like, it definitely ended?
It definitely has an ending.
Okay, all right.
That's all I'm going to say.
I mean, I think you mentioned that earlier. If they put the order of 17. And I was wondering, just thinking about it, it's like, oh, 17's a weird number for a British TV show. Does that mean a good or a bad thing?
You know, I honestly don't... I don't know... It wasn't, like, canceled or anything.
Right, They did everything that they wanted to. Or they, they designed to do.
Right.
Okay.
And I can't remember if I mentioned this at the top, but if I didn't, there's some, as people go into the history of the show and how it was made and how it was supposedly intended to have been made and filmed and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
There is some discrepancy over what, order you are quote unquote supposed to view the episodes in. Like you can go online and find alternate
orders
which, you know, I mean, if you're into that, go for it, but for the sake of this podcast, we're just going to be doing it in the order of the DVD set.
That makes more sense. The I think Patton Oswalt had done an interview. I guess there's some order that people now watch the Star Wars trilogy. They call it like the Hatchet Order or something, and you watch them completely out of order, and it's supposed to, I don't know if it illuminates something for you, but it's supposed to do something. But we'll be sticking to the DVD Netflix order of these episodes.
Yes, to maintain everybody's sanity. But I am by no means an authority on this.
Yep.
So if you're listening to this and you have anything that you'd like to add or correct me on, you can email me at theprisonerpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter or us on Twitter. At Prisoner Podcast, no the, just at Prisoner Podcast. I think that's it. Hope you enjoyed it, and we will be back in the future to cover The Chimes of Big Ben. So I hope you enjoyed it, and see you next time.
Thank you very much.
I should say be seeing you, but...
Well, they can't see your
but
hand.
I'm not a nerd.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks. So that was the first episode of Back in the Village. Thanks so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed it. My thanks to Wes, who will be back for the remaining 16 episodes. I hope you found it interesting and we didn't bore you too much. So we'll see you next time with The Chimes of Big Ben.